Welcome to Salty Moms Gone Sober. Whether you are a sober, curious, salty individual, can't seem to stay on the wagon, or have some successful sober time under your belt, our podcast creates a safe and comfortable space to let it all out. We can't guarantee anything but a good time and chill vibes. With a dash of humor, genuine language of the heart, and a salty truth throat punch here and there, connect with us on this unpredictable wave of sobriety. And when we find ourselves choking on a mouthful of saltiness, let's stop waiting to exhale and just spit some truth. Without further ado, your hosts, Alyssa Gruskin and Brie Juarez.
So I just thought I would share that tonight, you know, I got on to get ready for this episode and, you know, it was just me who signed on. No clue where Brie was or what she was doing. Apparently, the biatch fell asleep. Can you believe that? Craziness. How dare you fall asleep when we have an episode to record, Brie?
I was having sex. Sorry.
You were not having sex. You haven't been laid in like ages.
No, I wasn't. I fell asleep listening to a nursery rhyme with my children.
That's so sad and boring. I'm sorry.
But anyway, thanks, Alyssa, for that lovely introduction. So I think that we should like take this focus off of me and my fucking boring ass life and perhaps introduce this amazing guest that we have this evening on Salty Moms Gone Sober podcast. Alyssa, since you are feeling so sassy and talkative tonight, would you like to introduce her?
I would. So tonight we have Stephanie Noble. So happy that we finally get you here on our show, and we cannot wait to hear you share your story of hope. So Stephanie, why don't you take over?
Yes. Hello. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you guys for having me. And so I guess I can just jump right in and share some of my story. So my name's Stephanie, born and raised in Utah. I still live here. I just got married last month in Maui. So that was a really exciting thing that I was able to do, getting married sober. It was incredible. And I live here now with my husband and my two dogs, who are my children. So different kind of sober mom, sober dog mom, I guess. And in August, I celebrated 7 years clean and sober off all drugs and alcohol, which is truly unbelievable to even think about, because there was once a time where I could not go 1 hour without putting a substance into my system. So truly an incredible turn of events getting sober. So I want to say like my drugs and alcohol history started in high school, and I started drinking and smoking weed, and it was just, you know, the fun partying adolescent craziness. And I think the big, you know, the obsession of everything and the true depths of hell of my addiction started when I was 21. I was injured and I was prescribed opiate painkillers and started dabbling with that. At first I took them as prescribed. And so, you know, you think this came from a doctor, this can't be that bad for me. And pretty soon I found out I can make anything bad for me. So whether it's prescribed by a doctor or I get it at 7-Eleven or the liquor stores, I have a very addictive mind. So the painkillers is where it really started to unravel in a very dark way. And so I got up to doing like 10 Oxy 80s a day, which is truly unbelievable that I'm even here alive, especially when I would mix it with alcohol and Xanax and Adderall and all these other things that I was getting into, just because it was, you know, I wanted to escape my reality. Life was unbearable for me to do it sober. I couldn't even imagine doing it sober. And I know, you know, we talked before this and things like that of like trauma, because I think trauma really is the gateway drug. And my trauma is not like as, I don't know, I'm not going to compare it to other people's because trauma is relative. So the trauma in my life was my parents got divorced when I was 5. And even though my parents loved me so much, I had a very unstable childhood. We moved a lot. My parents fought a lot. Even when they broke up, they were still talking about each other all the time. And the message I took from that was just that my mom was saying my dad was bad, so I thought I was bad. My dad was saying my mom was bad, so I thought I was bad. So I just got this message in my head of that I'm not good enough. And so the trauma of my childhood was just the instability and that I felt unsafe. And so I think that's what kind of spiraled it to be where when I found substances, it was like it finally quieted that voice in my head that said I wasn't good enough. And when I found opiates especially, it was like, oh my gosh, this is what I've been searching for my whole life since I was 5 years old. And then it just went from there. So when the prescriptions ran out and the pills ran out and they changed the formula to OxyContin and they were trying to, you know, come down on the whole opiate epidemic, the only thing that was left for me was heroin. So I was introduced to heroin when I was 22, maybe 23. I don't know. It all blurs together when you try and tell your story. I'm like, I was so messed up that I don't know exactly, but in my early 20s. And heroin took me down a road that just got darker and darker and darker. And during all of this, I was still drinking and partying and, you know, doing whatever you can to not experience the withdrawal from opiates, because the withdrawal from opiates is actual hell on earth. I mean, withdrawal from any substance is excruciating, but opiates, it is a hell I would not wish on anyone. So you just keep it going and keep it going for the fear of getting sick. So it was a lot of heroin, all the things I never, quote unquote, never said I would do. I did all of them. Heroin. I never, ever in a million years would have thought I would ever be addicted to heroin. I never, ever, ever, ever thought that I would be an IV heroin user. And all of these things kept turning up in my life and becoming my new normal. And the standard for my life, or the line I swore I would never draw, just kept getting further and further away from existence until there was no line. And I was shooting heroin 10 times a day. And like I said, throughout all of this, drinking alcohol, I went to treatment for the first time in 2012. And I did 5.5 months in a residential treatment center and did day treatment and all those kind of things. So I stayed sober for a year. And the way I celebrated was by drinking, which is just what? But if you are a person like me, you probably can nod your head like you two are right now and be like, oh yeah, we get it, right? Because none of this makes sense. So I got sober for a year, celebrated by drinking, and very quickly the drinking became a big problem. And in my head, I was like, well, at least I'm not doing heroin, right? Like, this is so much better. At least I'm not doing heroin. I'm just going to drink. Drinking was never as big of a problem for me as alcohol or as heroin was. Very quickly, the alcohol became a big problem. And I got my first DUI in September of 2013. So then you're in that fear. I was in this fear of just like, oh my gosh, the consequences. And am I going to go to jail? And all of those things started stirring in my head, and those big emotions. And you know what I do with big emotions? I drink at them and I use at them because it's too much for me to handle, because I don't have coping skills. And So I kept drinking and I kept partying and I kept drinking and driving. And 8 months later, I got my second DUI in April of 2014. And then I was just like, oh my God, I'm so fucked. And the court system is slow. So I wasn't seeing consequences show up in my life. Not that consequences had ever really stopped me before. But again, I didn't know how to deal with it. And I continued to drink at it more, to use at it more. And I got my third DUI 2 weeks later in May of 2014. So the hat trick of DUIs. And then I started to kind of see consequences. I got an ankle monitor put on to test my skin for alcohol. And being the, you know, sneaky little conniving manipulative addict that I am, I was like, maybe if I don't charge it, they won't know. Sure enough, I didn't charge it and I could drink with the ankle monitor on. And I did that for quite some time. And until they were like, hey, we need to get you a new one. So that happened. And then I did get sober for a few months within there. I went to an intensive outpatient program and stayed sober for a while and had the new ankle monitor on. So I was like, okay, this one's actually working, so you can't drink on it. But I was like, oh, but I could go to my doctor and get Xanax. Because benzos were also a big part of this, right? Any type of pills were a big part of the story all along the journey. And so I went and got off the alcohol, went to my doctor, got pills and the Xanax. My whole process is always drinking. And if I can't drink, I go to Xanax. If I can't get Xanax, Oxy, and then heroin. That's just kind of my process. So I go and I get on benzos again. And then I start buying Oxy from a friend. And then when you're already in it, you're just like, okay, might as well go back to heroin. So I went back to heroin, and this was 2015 now. And so with some time sober in between, trying to get sober, but not really, I hadn't really reached that point of full willingness or full surrender that I can't use. There's no way, no matter how many times I've tried, that I can't successfully use in the way that I wanted to without really big life consequences coming up for me. And the substances that I use are obviously very deadly. And so it was only a matter of time until something really bad happened, as if 3 DUIs wasn't bad enough, right? Because we are special people in that regard. So yeah, got sober, went back to treatment, all that kind of stuff. And then in August of 2015, I relapsed again on heroin. I smoked heroin for 2 days, and then I was shooting it up for 1 day, took a day off thinking, you know, if I just use for 3 days, the withdrawals won't be as bad. It's so wild even telling this story, because I'm like, Stephanie, you make no sense. But when you're in it, it's like, it makes perfect sense that these crazy ideas like are going to work for you. So I smoked it for 2 days. I shot it up for 1 day, took a day off, and I went into full withdrawal, right? Because of the progressive nature of this disease, it remembers and it picks up right where it left off. So I was in full withdrawal and I couldn't handle the withdrawals. And so August 21st, 2015, I went and picked up some heroin from my dealer, and he warned me that this is really strong. He said, this is really strong. Be super careful. And I did not care. You don't think about things like that. You don't care. If anything, you're kind of like, ooh, good. It's strong. This is awesome. So I go in a grocery store parking lot and I shoot up and I overdose. And I think so. Someone saw me, obviously not looking alive, and called the cops to come do a wellness check on me. And if they didn't do that, I would not be sitting here today. I would have just been asleep forever. And my poor mother would have gotten a call that her daughter died in a parking lot with a needle in her arm. So I'm so grateful that somebody called and cared enough, or just, you know, knew enough, I guess, maybe, because who knows, someone else could have seen me and been like, oh, someone's sleeping in her car. So the cops come and they, you know, I get woken up and the whole thing happens, and I wake up and I'm just like, oh my gosh, because I knew it was now my fourth DUI, because I was in a car and I had control, right? And I was using substances. Substances were all around me. There was no denying it would be a DUI. So I just remember thinking, oh my God, I wish I would have just done more. Like, I wish I would have just done more. So this rat race in my head and this hamster wheel of destruction and sadness and pain would just be over. And it wasn't. And now I can say and look back and be so grateful that I didn't, because the past 7 years have just been complete opposite of what this story is that I'm telling you. So I get taken to jail, of course, and I am in withdrawal, and I detox in jail cold turkey off heroin again. And every single time I've detoxed off heroin, it's been cold turkey, and it's just a hell I would not wish upon anyone. And the day after, I remember, it's hard to explain, and it might sound crazy, but the people who have had the psychic change and like the burning bush moment, the spiritual awakening, that's what happened. And I wish there was like an eloquent, beautiful way I could put it into words, but there's just not. It felt like God, the universe, whatever higher power you believe in, some source energy, something came down and took it from me. And all of a sudden I wasn't in withdrawal anymore. And I just had this like clarity for the first time in 7 years, since like the really bad parts of my addiction had started, where I was like, oh my gosh, Kay, you're either going to die from this disease, like you almost just did a day ago, or you're just going to move forward and you're going to do whatever it takes to stay sober. And after that, I just had this sense of calm and this sense of willingness that I had never had before. This sense of like one foot in front of the other, you're going to listen to every single thing that the people who came before you say, and you're going to do everything. And I thought for sure I was going to prison, right? 4 DUIs is not a slap on the wrist type of situation. So I was terrified I was going to go to prison, but I was also like, at least it's not death. At least your mother will not have to bury her second child and her youngest daughter because of this disease. Like, prison you can get out of. Death you can't. So after I got out of jail a few days later, I went back to my intensive outpatient counselor and told him everything, and just completely humbled myself to the point where I was sobbing so much. I feel like I probably wasn't even making sense. And he was like, wow, humility looks good on you. Cause I don't think he had seen it before. Cause I was very much like that. I know what to do. I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to, you know, do certain things you say, but not the super uncomfortable things. I'm going to find a way to do this my way without fully surrendering and accepting this process of recovery. So I asked him, tell me what to do. I will do anything. Cause I clearly don't know what the fuck I'm doing. And I'm going to die if I do not get this under control. So he said, okay, go back to residential. And I was like, no, but I did. So I went back to residential for 2.5 months. Like 65 days. I did that. And then I got out and I did intensive outpatient again. And every single thing that was asked of me, I did it willingly because I knew that I was fighting for my life. And because of that psychic change, spiritual awakening, it just felt so much easier than what I was doing. What I was doing was clearly not working and it was killing me. So going to treatment and going to groups and talking to other people like you guys and people who get it was the easier decision after all, even though I had fought it for so many years. So I did intensive outpatient. And this whole time I'm waiting for my court date to come. And because I piled up a lot of DUIs in a very short amount of time, which is not great. And when I went to court, somehow my fourth DUI was dropped. And I still to this day have no idea how that possibly could have happened. And I only credit it to the miracles of recovery, because there's no other way that should have ever happened. My attorney was even like, sign this paper. The fourth DUI is dropped. Like, you could even see the shock in his face of like, what is happening? I still got drug possession charge, paraphernalia charges, things like that. But the fourth DUI was dropped, which was huge. So dealing with all the court stuff, I go to court for the sentencing on the third DUI. And my probation officer at the time had seen me through this recovery process. And he's like, wow, you look like shit on paper, but it looks like you're doing everything you need to be doing. And I think he kind of believed that I was walking the walk. So his recommendation to the judge was home confinement, which again is unbelievable and pretty much unheard of for a fourth or a third DUI. So I go to court and I'm like, awesome, recovery's the best. I'm not going to jail. I'm getting home confinement. And the judge laughed in my face. She was like, nice fucking try. 62 and a half days. And I got handcuffed right there to go to serve my time on my third DUI. And when the bailiff came up and handcuffed me, I had this sense of freedom still. And it makes me emotional because it's just, I'm standing there in handcuffs about ready to go to jail. And I was still free because I was like, I know what confinement feels like and it's addiction. And I know what a mental prison feels like and it's addiction. So me being a person in recovery, I was 7 months sober at the time and being handcuffed, I was like, let's do it. You know, whatever it takes, let's do it. And I get taken to jail. And while I was in jail, I had to go see the judge for the first two DUIs because obviously getting more is a probation violation. So I go to court and the prosecutor is asking for 6 months for the first probation violation, 6 months for the second probation violation, and he wanted them to be served consecutively. So he was asking for a year in jail. And I was already there for 62 and a half days. The 62 and a half days, I don't know why there's a half day, but whatever. That's the minimum mandatory in Utah. So the prosecutor was asking for a year, and I was just like, damn. And I was still in that place of like, okay, I'm gonna just face this, and I'm gonna do what I need to do. So I wrote a letter to the judge, and I still have it around here. It makes me cry when I read it, so I won't bore you with it, but I'll tell you like the highlights of it where I went in and I handed the letter to my attorney and I said, okay, give this to the judge. And he was like, I can't do that. I can't just give a letter to the judge. You have to read it. And I was like, oh my gosh, okay. So I read the letter and I kind of just told him what I had been doing the past 7 months. And I said, the one line that I remember saying that kind of like is pretty potent and powerful, I think, to this whole thing is, I said, if jail fixed what I had, I would beg for it. Jail does not fix this for me, right? There's the punishment does not fix addicts. And you can see that by the recidivism rate in prisons and jails because of substance abuse. They all go back because jail does not fix this. And if jail fixed it, yeah, I would be like, cool, let's do it. And then I leave and it's done. But that's not how it works. And I just said, I have treatment set up. I have meetings. I have all these things. And I was fully ready to just have him also laugh in my face like the other judge, but he didn't. He said to the prosecutor, if I put her in jail for a year, that's just a recipe for relapse. I'm taking her away from everything she's done. when she gets out, she's not going to have anything. So I'm going to close these cases. She's clearly working through it with the third DUI judge. So he closed my cases, let me go, wiped fines off of my thing. And again, I was just like, what is happening? And again, I say it's a miracle of recovery, because had I not been in the headspace I was to write the letter, to show up and really own my actions, that wouldn't have happened. So I finished out my sentence for the third DUI. I didn't have to do all of it in jail, which is also I'm grateful for. I did like 13 days in jail, and then I got out on ankle monitor. I've had many ankle monitors. One time I had one on each ankle, but anyway, so get out and do that. And from that's when like the legal stuff was behind me, which was such a great blessing. And finishing probation was a great blessing, but nothing changed because I wasn't ever doing it for probation. I had finally made the choice to do this recovery thing for myself. And I just kept doing whatever I needed to do. And every single day I made sure that I did something for my recovery. I got really into refuge recovery, which is the Buddhist-based approach to the 12 steps, and started a refuge meeting and did all those kind of things. And since all of that, life has just become a completely different story than what I had done before. So recovery opened up so many doors for me. I went back to school at the University of Utah at their School of Social Work to become a counselor so that I could help people who have been where I've been. So that's what I've been doing for the past 3.5 years, working as a substance use disorder counselor at an outpatient facility so that I can inspire people through my own story, yes, but also just to like show them it's possible and to help them save their own lives, because I know what it feels like. And so working with addicts and alcoholics is like the greatest gift of my life. And even still, when I go and speak and share my story at treatment centers or on podcasts or things like that, I'm baffled, because when I tell this story of this person, I have no idea who she is, but I know she's me. Like, that's how different of a life I'm living now than I was back then. And so the miracles of recovery just don't ever end. And I'm so grateful to be here and to be sober and to be able to share my story, because I know people have been there and through that like helplessness and hopelessness, and it gets better. And it gets so much better. Oh my gosh, I can't even put it into words, but my life today looks nothing like it did before. And yeah, I think that's like the gist of it.
So you were telling us that you were taking a different approach, refuge Buddhist approach. Could you elaborate a little bit about that? I'm not too familiar with that, and I'm sure our listeners would love to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, so refuge recovery is a Buddhist. I know there's also Dharma recovery, because especially like I'm from Utah, and so a lot of people in Utah have religious trauma, and the idea of God or the idea of a 12-step program is very, it's triggering, and it's also some people just are very resistant to it. So the Buddhist-based approach is no God talk. So it's very much mindfulness, meditation, Buddhist principles that I think a lot of people with trouble with the God stuff or people with religious trauma can get into a little bit more easily than a Christian-based or a God-based 12-step program. But I think they all work. I think we can all get past the God word. And I know people have stuff around that, but people die because they can't get past the God word. And so I would urge people to just be open to everything. Like I was saying, just be completely open to whatever, finding what works and building your program off of something like that.
Yeah, I love how you say that. A rose by any other word would smell as sweet.
Yeah.
The God thing for me, a huge barrier. And still to this day, I mean, the word God makes me cringe. My higher power is the universe. As you mentioned, growing up in Utah, where religion of whatever capacity it is pounded into you. And if you take one step outside of those boundaries of that religion, you are shaming the family. You are no longer a part of the family. You are banned from everything. And so it's really refreshing to hear that in communities and areas that are afflicted by that have different approaches called something else, even though it is is very similar and probably the same thing as AA's 12-step program or NA's 12-step program, but uses a different higher power, the point is knowing that I am not in charge here.
Yes. Yes.
I do not hold the key to anything. I am not the puppet master. And when I think that I am, I fuck shit up. And
yes,
that's really, I guess, how did your like parents, your sister, any other siblings react to you? Like, did they pretend it wasn't happening?
So at first, yes. So yeah, my parents divorced when I was five. My dad never wanted to go back to the church, so he didn't. I was baptized in the church, the LDS church. Sorry, I say the church still. Oh my gosh, that's so crazy. I was baptized in the LDS church, and my dad, after my parents split, my dad had no intention on staying with the church. My mom did. My mom stayed in the church and in the LDS church in some capacity for quite some time, and then finally has left completely because of, not because of me or my addiction, but mostly because of the LGBTQ plus community. She just cannot get on board with the way that they're treated in, or the way they're viewed in the LDS church, which, go mom, I love you. She's a great ally. So I love that. And so we were kind of Jack Mormon is what they call us here. Like, where we were baptized, but we weren't practicing devout, you know, and I have addiction completely riddled on both sides of my family. So aunts, uncles, cousins, my father, grandparents. So addiction is no stranger in my family. And I have big families, right? Because I'm from Utah. My mom is one of nine children. My dad is one of eight. So in these huge families, addiction is no stranger. So, but I do think in the beginning, especially with like the pills and stuff like that, it was this very like, oh, it's, you know, it's not that bad. It's the doctors or whatever. And then as it progressed and the consequences started showing up, I started looking different, acting different, being different. It was, I think a lot of family didn't know what to do. I have a lot of family members who are in recovery and who have been for decades. And so luckily we had this example of what recovery looks like in our family. So I wasn't like the guinea pig. So there was, you know, my mom, she tried to love it out of me, which we know doesn't work. And you know, we went through a whole process of her trying to babysit it out of me and helicopter mom it out of me and love it out of me. And then the whole, I hate you, I'm going to kick you out type of thing, the tough love thing. And no matter what, it was always just about my willingness and my readiness to do something about it. But when I was sober for that year, I mean, everything got so much better, of course. And I had the support of my family and things like that. But yeah, so we weren't like shunned or whatever. Like, we had our own process and familiarity with addiction. And so, but I think it's just hard because even though my mom was well aware of addiction and the things that it does, when it's your own child, I can't imagine how much knowledge just goes out the window, because I can't imagine the fear she felt all the time, especially with the substances I was using, that the fear of me dying was probably the most visceral thing in her soul. And I can't imagine anyone doing it perfectly, but she was, without her, I don't think I would even have survived in addiction as long as I did, be there to support me. And I thank God every single day that I had that I have a mom that I do, because she's incredible, truly incredible.
So it sounds like there was definitely some codependence there.
Oh, yes.
You know, some of that going on. But in the end, ultimately, she stayed by your side, and that meant more to you than anything. So I want to ask you also, you know, when you switched over from opiates to heroin, and I assume you probably first started smoking heroin. Right. Okay. Can you describe how you got introduced to IV use, kind of like how that influence was on you and how that high was different, how that maybe even almost like using a different drug kind of?
Yeah. So I got introduced to it by an ex-boyfriend. So that I met in detox. And just PSA to everyone, the people you meet in detox and rehab, don't get in relationships with them. Don't get in relationships with them, because it's very sick. So, and you guys are laughing really hard. Is one of you in a relationship with someone you met in detox or rehab?
I am.
Oh, okay. Okay. Experience. So you're like one of the first, but
it's rare. It's hard work.
Yes. Anyway, in for the majority people. So yes, it can work, but don't always think you're going to be the anomaly. Alyssa's the anomaly. We found her. No one else is. So the end. But so it was an ex-boyfriend I met in detox. And even so then we formed a relationship, right? Because it's like, my sickness in another person. We can be sick together and call it love. So that was like our dynamic. And he had been an IV heroin user. And for a long time, it was like, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. Until one day I was like, hey, I want to try that. And he was like, no, for like 10 minutes. And then was like, okay, thank you for that. And as far as it being different, it is. And it is like a different experience, a different intensity, and just takes it to a different level where it's almost, you know, just sucks the rest of your soul. If there's anything left at that point, it sucks the rest of it out. As far as like the feelings of it, I don't care to go into it in case it's triggering for someone. But if you know, you know. And being away from it and looking back, it's just like, oh my gosh, I'm so grateful I survived something like that, because so many people don't. So that was how I got into that level of it. Again, one of those things you just never think you're gonna do, and you do. So glad I'm not doing that anymore.
So just like that, a person just shows you how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You just need to be shown how to do it. And then that's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
Like once you become an IV user, I feel nothing compares.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's like always the high that is like the one being searched for, mm-hmm. even though you're not always going to get it. And it makes me emotional thinking about looking at you, talking to you, and knowing what you do now, even if you didn't do what you do now. The person that you are, the human being, the heart, the soul, the kindness, the gratefulness, and picturing you in this hopeless, helpless death hole of darkness. It's just like you say that you telling the story, you're like, I can't even believe that these words are coming out of my mouth. And like, as I'm hearing them and trying and picturing you, like, I can't even, hurts my heart and my stomach, like almost if I was your mom or something, you know what I mean? Like, I would not be okay seeing you in that kind of pain.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard for our family members. And you said your mom did the best that she could while seeing you go through that. It's just, we forget about all the people that love us, how they're coping with this stuff too. Mm-hmm. And then like, how are they going through rehabilitation and recovery from the trauma that they've gone through that we put them through?
Right. And I think that's like such an important part to bring up, because the quote unquote identified patient, right, we're kind of the ones that are thrown into treatment centers and detoxes and meetings and therapy and things like that when it is a family disease and it affects everyone around you. And I think that there could definitely be more of an emphasis and more resources to help the families. And so luckily when I went to treatment, they had family night and things like that. So my mom would come and she would get some of that education she needed, and then also her own therapy and stuff like that. But it's so needed, because it's hard on us because we're like, oh my gosh, I caused all this, but by no fault of our own, like no true intention. I didn't go out and be like, can't wait to cause my mom trauma. That is a symptom. That's the collateral damage of addiction. And so I think that the families getting help is super important, because we feel like it's our responsibility when really our responsibility is our own recovery. And by making living amends and changing our behavior, showing that we are different. And if we try and take on the trauma of our entire families, it's going to be a huge load to carry. So pointing our families in the direction, showing them a different way, especially when so many families are codependent, like my own. I have a very codependent family. Luckily, we've done a lot of work to kind of help some of that. But coming from codependency, I wanted to fix everything for her. I wanted to completely take it away and fix it and overcompensate it at the sake of my own recovery to help my mom, and, you know, because of my codependency issues. And so having the families get help is huge in this process. And having them Absolutely. Be educated on addiction is huge in this process.
Mm-hmm. And I really hope that our listeners are taking that in. Just listen to those words and let that digest and spread that word. Because not only are we wanting to help the people suffering in silence that are the active substance, you know, have the substance use disorder, have the addiction, but their families are suffering in silence too.
Absolutely.
And we want to help. We want to be there and let them know that there are ways for to lift that weight off of them, or to help them rewire what they have fucked up in their head because of what they think they need to do to make their daughter survive this shit. Or their son survive this shit. They do have a child that's OD'd and didn't survive. And we think we feel guilt and shame. Think of how that parent feels.
Absolutely.
And we know we need maybe therapy or AA or refuge recovery or whatever that is. We know that our family members that suffer next to us and with us through this don't. Mm-hmm. And so I just really think that that's a huge take home message from like our conversation this evening that I really hope that our listeners take seriously.
Yeah.
And so 4 DUIs, that's a lot.
Yes, it is.
You're lucky you did not kill yourself or somebody else.
Oh, and I thank my higher power every single day that I never got in an accident, that I never hurt someone, because people lose people from drunk driving all the time. And so I realize, and I'm sensitive to the people. I don't, sometimes when I talk about it, it seems like this very, oh, and I got 4 DUIs, like it was a Tuesday and just whatever, but it's, I know how serious the topic of drunk driving is. And I'm very sensitive to the people who have been affected by drunk driving. And I've been taken through the ringer on social media because of that. And I get it, because again, so many people are lost because of drunk driving. So I recognize that. And when people say, what were you thinking? You should be in prison for life. You know, all of these things. It's like, I wasn't thinking in the same way that normal people think, right? The part of the brain that affects, that holds decision-making and consequential thinking and self-awareness, that part is very much affected in addiction. And so I wasn't thinking, and I hate, and it's not an excuse. The disease model and the brain stuff is not an excuse, but it's an explanation, because I would never do that in my right mind. And in addiction, you're not in your right mind. But it's heartbreaking. And I'm so, so grateful that I never hurt anyone. Like that, it could have been me that killed someone in a drunk driving accident so easily. And I'm so glad it wasn't. And I use my story to try and help people. And I'm so grateful I did not hurt someone. But yeah, it's a lot. And it's horrifying to think about it.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that you spent some time and do spend time kind of reflecting on that. And I can only imagine how humbling it is when you look back on that and when you tell your story, because the one thing you can do after something like that is tell your story and share it with another sick and suffering addict.
Yep.
Because the hope is that you can plant that seed so they aren't out getting 4 DUIs or one that is the one that takes someone's life or their own. So what you're choosing to do with that, instead of being like, yeah, it was 4 DUIs, because you're not like that at all.
Yeah.
You know,
I just always want to be sensitive, because I have shared about this before, and looking back, I was like, wow, I can say it so lightly. And that's not to speak to how much regret I have. I think that shows how much therapy I've had, because I know how serious the topic of drunk driving is. And I'm very sensitive to that. And like you said, the best thing I can do is show that I'm never going to do it again. And I haven't had a sip of alcohol in over 7 years. So I think that that's some good foundation of proof. And then to share my story in hopes that people can learn and say, hey, you don't have to wait until it gets to where I got before you reach out and surrender and ask for help, because it never gets better. Addiction never gets better. better. It gets worse and worse and worse, and it's progressive. And even after some time clean, it picks up where it left off. The brain remembers like the brilliant machine that it is. So I hope that in sharing my story, even though it is such a sensitive topic of drunk driving, that people can hear it and be like, oh my gosh, this could happen to me. And more likely than we think, like this happens all the time. So I hope that in sharing that it helps people realize like you don't have to wait for it to get to where I got it, and you can reach out and there's help out there before it gets to where you're like, oh, am I going to die or go to prison? Like, it doesn't have to be such a rock bottom.
Right. Because your bottom was pretty spiky.
Oh, yes.
Lots of rocks there. And so you kind of, it sounds like you had like, after your very thoughtful drug dealer warned you of the potency of the heroin he was selling you, because you don't get that warning very often from your dealer.
He wanted to keep a customer alive.
Yeah, I guess so. But you know, you knew better and you said, well, fuck, this is great. Mm-hmm. You know, after you essentially somebody, something, somewhere, somehow saved your life when you OD'd. Mm-hmm. And so here you are, you know, and you're having like this spiritual awakening, and it's going like hand in hand with the gift of desperation, right? Mm-hmm. And this moment of clarity. And then so here's your window of opportunity. Like this is your window that like if you think something in your mind, or if someone says something to you where, you know, like it's about recovery and it's about like, this has got to stop. I've got to find the true solution. I need to stop escaping my reality and figure out what my reality is and what it is I'm running from. And, you know, it's a very, very, very tiny window. And if you are not seriously impacted within that window, it will pass. And you know that. I mean, you had a year of sobriety under your belt before you celebrated with a drink and it turned into IV heroin use again. So you know full well, like, what that is. And you had that. Do you remember anybody or anything being, like, that next influential thing that happened to you after kind of, like, all of this inner awakening is happening? Like, what happened next that actually got the ball rolling of like, this is fucking real?
It's gonna sound so like, you know, when you have those moments where you've heard something before but you're in a different state of mind and so it sticks. So when I got out of jail after that time and I went back to my counselor, his name is Brett, and he is like an angel in my life and an angel in my story. He's helped me so much, and he was decades sober at the time, so I trusted that he knew, right? So going to the people who know and who have been there. And when I got out of jail and I went to see him, and like I was saying, that just like humility of like, I don't know, please tell me what to do, because I was just willing to take action. So I went to someone, because my great ideas, they always ended me in jail or getting arrested or almost dying. So I went to someone who I was like, his ideas are clearly better than mine, and I'm going to ask him for a roadmap. And no matter what he says, I'm going to do it. So everything he said to do, I did. And I lived in consultation with him for years, because I still didn't trust my own thinking. But I was sitting in his office and having that moment of like, oh my gosh, my life's a mess again. And, you know, all that kind of stuff. And he kind of laid out the plan for me, and he said, and don't use no matter what. And that was, and I like started crying, and I was like, and it clicked for me. And I know that sounds like so stupid and easy, because it's not that easy to just don't use. Like, how many times did people tell us that? And we were like, oh, really? It's that easy? But in that moment where I was just ready, he laid out the plan. And I think just in passing, it wasn't even like one of his, hey, this is my spiritual amazing thing I'm going to say to you. He was like, and don't use no matter what, in this very matter of fact way. And I was like, no matter what. Okay. And something clicked in me. I'll never forget him saying that. But the plan was laid out. I was willing. I was just going to do whatever he told me to and stop getting in my own way and stop thinking that I knew better, because clearly I didn't know shit and I wasn't going to use no matter what. And so that's kind of just what I ran with, and days stacked up and I had big things I was facing, and still, no matter what, I wasn't going to pick up because I had other things to do. And as I learned those skills and coping skills and support system and all those things, I knew that those were the things I was going to choose instead of escaping my reality. So it's very powerful to me. And I know that might may not be the most powerful thing for the listeners because they've heard that, right? Don't use no matter what. But in the moment of true surrender, true willingness to do whatever it took, even the shit that I'd been avoiding, like step work and, you know, praying and whatever he said, I was like, I'm going to try it all. Meditation. I fucking hated meditation. And I went all in on it. And I went all in on mindfulness because it's still the foundation of my recovery program today, of just that slowing down and choosing something different. But I didn't use no matter what. And today I won't, no matter what.
And it's because he said it in your window of opportunity. Your desperation, the final gift of desperation. He said it at the right time. And that's the power.
It was like imprinted on my soul because I was just ready for it.
Yeah. You were done with the pain and you were done hurting other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was done with all of it because it was going to kill me. And I got face to face with death, and it was finally like the denial who just completely was like, bitch, we can't even help you now. Like, there's no denial left in this. Because you just almost died. A matter of 5 minutes, right? A matter of the cop hitting a red light on the way and I could have been dead. So this very real wake-up call of there's no denying it anymore. And that was a 4-day relapse that almost killed me, right? Because I had been clean, smoked it for 2 days, shot it, you know, 4 days. And it got to the point where I was going to die. So there's no relapse left in me. If I know for a fact with every fiber of my being, if I use again, I'm dying. There's just no denial left in my soul about that. So I stay in recovery because who knows if I could have another one. The next relapse, I will die. And I'm just completely surrendered to that. So I stay here in seats like this, in rooms with you, with people like you guys, because this is how I stay alive and live a really magical life.
So what does recovery look like for Stephanie Noble now?
It looks like I'm still on the pink cloud after 7 years. And I know that sounds crazy. And I know that people have this idea of what the pink cloud is, but I know there are ups and downs in life. I've gone through deaths and heartache and lots of things since getting sober, and I deal with it. And I still am so jazzed about recovery. It's like annoying, like truly. And I don't care. I don't care if people think my cheerful nature of recovery is annoying. I don't care because I love it here. And it's true freedom. It's freedom to wake up without being chained to a substance that you're going to get sick without. And it's freedom to show up for my family, show up for my mom, because she showed up for me so many times, and having a wonderful relationship with someone who, he's a normie or a pickle or a cucumber, and I'm a pickle, but he knows about the pickle life and he's so caring and supportive and wonderful, and we live an incredible life. And I'm able to help other people, which is the heart and soul of my recovery program, is giving away what was given to me. And helping other people as they save their own lives. So offering hope and offering skills and tools for other people to then pick up and see if they want to use it as they save their own life, because we all have a guarantee to make it. And I want everyone to make it. I don't like statistics of this disease because it's heartbreaking. Statistics can be changed, and we all have a guarantee of getting better. We just have to find a program that works for us, work with other addicts and alcoholics, and don't use no matter what. So recovery to me is just, it's freedom, complete freedom.
Like you said, even when you had those handcuffs slapped on your wrists going back to jail, but you were 7 months of true sobriety.
Yes.
You were like, you still felt the freest you've ever felt, and you were headed right back to incarceration, but your mind was free from addiction. That's some powerful fucking shit right there.
Thank you. It was.
I'm serious.
I was like, oh, I'm going to just get home confinement. And they were like, no, the fuck you're not. Here's some handcuffs. And I still was like, I'm free. I'm in handcuffs. and I'm free. And that's when I was like, you can do anything. Mm-hmm. You can do anything if you're sober because you're in handcuffs and you're free. So.
And you believed in yourself. You knew you had a problem. You knew you needed help. You knew that there was help out there, but you were finally ready and worth it in your own mind. Yeah. You literally looked death in the face. Mm-hmm. And you realized how much you were worth surviving this addiction mm-hmm. and surviving this disease and spreading the word. And I admire that so much, Stephanie, and all the things that you do. And thank you so much for being a guest with us. And Alyssa.
Yes, thank you so much. You. Such a beautiful recovery story and everything you've been through and moving forward and helping all these people. It's just incredible. I'm just really honored that you were able to be here tonight and share your story with us.
Yes. Thank you guys. Thank you guys for what you guys are doing and for putting this out there and for asking me to be part of it. I'm sure it wasn't the exact story you were expecting, but it's a story I got and it's a story I'm going to tell. I appreciate you guys for staying up so late because I know it's like 10:30 there. So you guys are a sober mom warriors for doing it this late at night when I know we all want to like go to sleep.
Thank you so much to all our listeners. If you like what you heard, tune in next Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for another episode of Salty Moms Gone Sober. Be there or be square. And in the meantime, stay salty, stay sober, stay sane. Peace.